Good afternoon, members and members of the public. I'll call the Thursday, February 24th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules to order. And we'll go a little bit out of our order on our agenda and start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 510. And Erin, could you briefly explain this bill?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 510 requires investment officers and assistant investment officers an investment decision of Division of Office of State Treasurer to file a statement of economic interest, declares emergency is effective upon passage.
Thank you, Erin. And I see Senator Boquist in the audience, so if you'd like to come forward and tell us about this bill. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm assuming you do Rules and Rules Committee, right? I'm Senator Brian Boquist. I represent Senate District 12, which is portions of six counties, rural portions of six counties in the Willamette Valley. As you all recall, for Senator Beyer, over the last couple of years, I've had some extended discussions with several of the state treasurers and some discussions on the Oregon Investment Council in terms of transparency. And then, of course, there was an unfortunate incident that was in the newspaper that, you know, led a lot of members of the public to, you know, question transparency in terms of state finances. And again, it was unfortunate because, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, and in some cases where there's smoke, it's blown over from someplace else. So the old adage, where smoke is fire, is not necessarily true. During those discussions, though, one of the things that came up is to improve public confidence within the Treasury and within the financial realm in the state of Oregon. And, of course, there's been a lot of proposals out there that have said stuff, but, of course, what we know has worked in the past is the transparency that is used for us members, and that is the Statement of Economic Interest. And if you look at the bill and you don't have anything else to do this evening and you want to go to sleep, you can start reading through the list of everybody who files a statement of economic interest, from the office director of the Office of Emergency Management to the Racing Commission. Of course, I can get the Racing Commission because there's a lot of money, but some of these people don't have a lot of money. But having said that, and as we look down at the bottom in the bold on the third page, what I proposed and in discussions with the Treasury is that there is a small subset of individuals besides the Treasurer himself and the Deputy Treasurer that deal with large dollar transactions. And I'm not talking about large payments for groceries. I'm talking about payments in the hundreds of millions, if not billions, in regards to Treasury funds that they manage. To improve transparency and simply to improve public confidence, it seemed rational, and it still seems rational today, that since public officials in positions of leadership provide a economic interest statement that the public can reach out in touch, that a simple solution, rather than recreate the wheel and recreate regulations and say we must do this or that for these individuals, is simply require them to do what the rest of the public officials do. And that way, if someone lacked the confidence or someone was interested in what their economic interests were, that there might be a conflict because there's not been any discovered conflicts, that they could go to the Oregon Ethics Commission, just like any other citizen, and get Senator Farioli's statement of economic interest or Senator Atkinson's, and it would be simply transparent. It's a simple bill. The only difference between Senate Bill 510 realistically and Senate Bill 269 is the relating clause, and my relating clause is very narrow, which is the statement of economic interest. And the other relating clause is my favorite one, in which I went to court over ethics. So, having said that, Madam Chair, it's the committee's preference. I would just suggest that to all committee members, if we want to see transparency, if we want to improve public confidence in the Treasury office, when we see some of these unfortunate newspaper reports, that this is a good option. And with that, I'd be delighted to take questions, Madam Chair, or members.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. Any questions for the senator? It looks like you've already answered them all. Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair, for being here, and we'll let you get back to your other duties. Great. So I will temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 510. We will be coming back to it, members. And I'll open our informational meeting for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And I will call forward Ron Burson to tell us what they've been up to.
Good
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And I guess I'd like to go over the last couple of years of what the commission has done, and if there's any questions along the way, feel free to interrupt me, and at the end we can have any questions too. Over the last couple of years, the commission, with the changes in Senate Bill 10 with Senate Bill 30, was required to come back and rewrite its administrative rules. So over the last, I guess, approximately year and a half or so, we have rewritten those rules. We were able to work with the stakeholders that were very helpful in completing that rule changes, and those rules have been filed, and we are operating underneath those new administrative rules. At the same time, or after the administrative rules, then we went on to rewrite the public official guide, which is kind of the next level of understanding that folks can use. It's supposed to be a little more layperson type terms. And again, we recruited the help of the stakeholders to come in and help us rewrite that book so that kind of everybody was on the same page and try to have some better understanding. With the changes in Senate Bill 30, the book grew by a bit as opposed to what it was before because of the number of exceptions that were out there, and just frankly some of the increase in explanation on legislative administrative interest with the changes again with Senate Bill 30. The commission has updated its advisory opinions that are on its website to eliminate the advisory opinions that were no longer valid because of the changes in the laws over the last 4 years. Those advisory opinions are still out there. They're underneath our historical part of the site, but they're not in the portion where somebody can just come in and try to get some kind of guidance and get misled by some of the older statutes that were changed. One of the exciting things that we've done over the last couple of years is that the commission's really tried to change its focus from compliance towards training. And one of the challenges with training the number of public officials out there has been just the access to those people. And so one of the solutions we came up with was to work with the Department of Administrative Services and use their iLearn program that's available to state agencies at no cost. And so we have created, currently there's 8 modules out there that's on our website that any public official can go to that website 24 hours, 7 days a week, and look at those modules, and it'll give them at least a cursory overview of the responsibilities. And the modules vary from executive sessions, so if a local jurisdiction out there was going to have an executive session and maybe they don't have access to an attorney, they can get some guidance from us on what they can actually do with executive sessions. That's a small portion of the public meeting laws that the Ethics Commission oversees. To conflicts of interest, it gives local public officials an idea of what is a conflict of interest and when they're required to declare that conflict of interest and how they take care of that. So we've been really excited about that. It's been really starting to be used more and more. We're getting a lot more hits on that, and at this time we're still creating more modules. In fact, there's 2 that should come out here very shortly. The trainers themselves have also been traveling and meeting with different groups of people and training face-to-face on these new laws and rules out there with a lot of local jurisdictions around the state. We've gotten very favorable comments from those jurisdictions about the commission coming out and trying to kind of solve these problems before somebody makes an inadvertent mistake and finds himself before the commission on a compliance issue. The commission, as required by statute, has performed numerous audits on the reports filed with the commission. Those are lobbyist reports, and in the last bill talked about statements of economic interest. In 2007, the changes with Senate Bill 10, one of the things it did was it aligned the time between lobbyists and the entities that hire lobbyists to file at the same time. They file quarterly. So in the past, the entities would file once a year and the lobbyists would file 2 or 3 times a year depending on if it was a legislative year or not. And so it was very difficult to kind of match those reports between what a lobbyist had reported and what an entity that hired them had reported on spending money. And of course, with those audits, there's been numerous discoveries of where reports were not filed when they were required to be filed, or some mistakes that were made on reports. And so I think a bill that we're going to talk about later addresses some of the problems that the commission has seen with kind of the increase in the number of issues that come before the commissioners on simply the reports that are being filed and the mistakes that are on those reports. The commission has provided hundreds of email advice. In 2009, the legislature actually kind of increased the protections for people that were seeking advice, and so the less formal types of advice were given more protections, and we found at the commission that people are really using that opportunity to contact us and ask us kind of those last-minute type questions right before something happens or right before they'd like to do something to get that quick turnaround to know if they can accept something or what's required of them as far as reporting goes. So it's really been helpful, I think, for the people out there. The other thing is the changes in 2009, the removal of relatives and members of households, so that was a big change for the statements of economic interest, and we have found that we have not had the problems that we had before when those items were included on that statement. Lastly, the commission in 2007, Senate Bill 10 actually created a new funding model for the commission. The commission transformed from a general fund agency to another fund agency through an assessment program, and half of the assessment is through state agencies, and their assessment is on a per FTE, full-time equivalent, position, so they pay per the number of employees that they have. On the other side, local government participates in funding of the Ethics Commission, and the way that assessment works is there are 8 levels of the municipal audit fee that comes out of the Secretary of State's office, the smallest one being $20 and the largest one being $400. The smallest jurisdictions that have expenditures under $50,000 would pay the smallest amount. Jurisdictions over $50 million of expenditures would pay the largest amount. We have set up an assessment with those local jurisdictions. There's about 1,700 of them. That's cities, counties, and special districts. Over the last biennium, in the first year of the biennium, the commission had asked for $500,000 from those local jurisdictions, and the majority of that was collected. We saw that the compliance rate was really high, so we came in the interim. We actually asked the Ways and Means Committee to lower that assessment down to $400,000 in the second year of that biennium, creating a total of $900,000 as opposed to the $1 million we asked for from the 2009 Legislative Ways and Means Committee. We have found that the compliance with the local jurisdictions has been extremely high, with only $6,402 that has not been paid to the commission in that biennium, which creates over a 99% compliance rate from those local jurisdictions. So I think with the effort of the commission and the effort of the associations getting the word out to their members that this assessment was coming about, made for a very successful program. And so we've really been pleased with that. So it turned out to be a very reliable funding model. Now, some challenges that the commission has seen over the last couple of years, again, the lack of electronic reporting system. As you probably know, there was one in the works, and with the downturn of the economy, that general fund money was turned back in for other purposes, and so the electronic reporting system was put off until January of 2013. We have found that we were not able to include that in our budget this year, so we'll need to move that up to 2015. But at one time, we're going to have to talk about actually making these reports become electronic. What the agencies try to do in the meantime to try to help people have better access to our records is we have scanning capabilities, so if people call us and need my statement of economic interest, we can go ahead and scan that in and give them an electronic copy, which I think people really appreciate at no cost to them, as opposed to doing a public records request where we're having to mail and have some cost to them. Another area that we found very challenging this last biennium is the area of turnover. The commission has experienced higher than usual rate of turnover, not just for employees, but for commission members themselves. through exit interviews, what we have found is that with the current kind of compensation package for employees, that they have simply looked for promotional opportunities in other places. We've had one retirement, and there's been a couple of promotions. Well, when you have an agency of seven people other than myself, you start turning over basically half of your staff, and you lose a lot of experience. And so we've been challenged by training those new people coming in. We've also experienced a high rate of turnover in commissioners. I started with the commission in November of 06, and there are no commissioners from that time left on the commission. And in fact, our current chair is the eldest member, or been there the longest, and they will their term will end in September. And so, again, we kind of lose that experience that commissioners have. It's great that we get new blood, new people in there, but it's been a challenge for just keeping the commissioners kind of trained on the changes and having that kind of historical experience that's out there. The last area, which isn't a large area, I mentioned it as a success as far as the assessment goes, that we've had a very high compliance rate, and there's only $6,402. The problem that we see is in the law, we're eventually going to have to, this is going to become an equity type of issue, and we're going to have some kind of mechanism to get the people that are not paying to go ahead and pay it. Like I say, it's a very small amount right now. I don't think it's something that we have to do right away, but it's something that I think we need to keep an eye on, because what we found is that the groups that did not pay in the first year of the biennium also have not paid in the second year of the biennium, and so I assume when the next assessment comes out, they will probably not pay in that year also. So that concludes my report, Madam Chair, if there's any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Burson? I don't see any. So thank you very much for the report. And please stay with us, because I know we have another matter under consideration that will be of interest to you. So we'll look forward to hearing from you again.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'll close the informational hearing. And we should just have a work session. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 270. And members, Erin, I should probably turn it over to you to tell us where we are on Senate Bill 270.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 270 was heard in public hearing on February 4th. Senate Bill 270 modifies provisions related to campaign finance penalties, establishes a cap on civil penalties for failure to file statement or include required information, and changes period for assessing civil penalties for violations of campaign finance reporting requirements. You have with you a -4 amendment. The -4 amendment it deletes unfulfilled pledges, subscription agreement, or promise to make contribution from definition of contributions, deletes requirement that candidate or political committee submit bank account number when reporting, and removes the emergency clause from Senate Bill 270. There is a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued on the -4 amendments.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Senator Ferrioli.
Is it your intention to move the -4 amendments?
That is my intention.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Ferrioli has moved that we adopt the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 270. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I was just curious as to why the emergency clause was taken out.
I believe the emergency clause was taken out in order to allow the agency to implement this bill without a fiscal impact. I think that was what we found out, is that to do it that quickly would perhaps cause a cost. So
that makes sense.
And
thank you.
Seemed like the other changes could be made along with that. So this bill got obviously a little thicker than its original bill, but I think, as Erin just told us, it includes two of the bills that we considered at our initial hearing, the one that did away with the requirement of reporting pledges along with the original content, and then a new idea which had come forward from some of the members of the committee, which was it not being necessary to report actual bank account numbers, and perhaps not only not a great idea to do that, given that that information is public record. So, further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, Mike, do you want to call the roll on the amendment?
Senator Atkinson? Yes.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Amendment is adopted. Senator Ferrioli?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. I move that Senate Bill 270 is amended. Go to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Bill 270 as amended with the dash force to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Senator Atkinson.
So when we heard this bill originally, the proponents for this bill and the other bill, which we've just collided together, made comments about being fined by the Secretary of State for a variety of things that were minor, nickel and dime things, frankly. This bill, as amended, does not address those issues. Is that right?
I think it would be fair to say this bill does not address everything that was commented on at the hearing. It does certainly address many of the comments that were made, though.
But not the... we've got the big cap. We've got the pledge thing, but we don't have all of the little nickel and dime things that committees are always stuck with, whether they're professional committees or non-professional committees. Is that right?
I think it would be fair to... I'm not quite sure how to answer the nickel and dime because I'm not sure what that refers to. I think what the bill does is set a cap on fines that are currently unlimited under law, and I think that was an inadvertent failure to do so in the last legislative session. So,
last question. The Secretary of State's election division is still neutral, or are you for this bill?
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. There is a motion before us. Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
I'm going to be a no.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair
Rosenbaum? Aye. Motion carries. And we need a carrier for this bill. And Senator Beyer, I don't think I've actually seen you carry a bill on the floor yet.
This morning.
This session. Did you carry a bill
morning,
this morning?
Madam Chair.
Oh, so we missed the opportunity.
Yeah, no. Madam Chairman, it was such a good carry. I really would like to
hear
another
train whistle.
Another carry.
So, Senator Beyer, would you?
I would be happy to.
Thank you very much. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 270. And I will open a public hearing on both Senate Bill 269 and Senate Bill 510. And, Erin, we already briefly introduced one of these bills, but did you want to comment on them?
Thank you, members. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 269 and Senate Bill 510 both require investment officers and investment officers and assistant investment officers in the investment division of the state treasurer's office to file a statement of economic interest. The difference between the two, as pointed out by Senator Boquist, is relating to clause, and Senate Bill 269 does not have an emergency clause on it. You do have two amendments with 269, the dash one, which exempts from disclosure by a public official expenses with an aggregate value exceeding $50 received while participating in mission negotiations or economic development if the expenses are received by the official pursuant to a contract entered into by the public official that the official serves and the value of the expenses are not made available to that public official. And the dash 2 amendment, which prohibits Oregon Government Ethics Commission from imposing civil penalty on a public official if the public official acted in accordance with rule or policy adopted by the state agency that the official serves that was not otherwise rejected by the Oregon Government Ethics Commission.
Thank you, Erin. So I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 510. I do see two people signed up on Senate Bill 269, and they are Darren Bond and Michael Salvaggio. So if the two of you would like to come forward, please do so. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Rules Committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. And as the committee administrator pointed out, what this bill does, I'll be very brief on our summary and say that The State Treasury does support the concept of having the investment officers fill out statements of economic interest. As was also noted, we do have two amendments that the Treasury has requested and would like added on to that. One, the dash one amendments speaking to the integrity of our contracts and disclosure rules. The idea here is that if an expense is required to be made to a public employee pursuant to a contract that has been entered into, and as an example, we're talking about investment contracts with private equity firms that require certain expenses to be paid when we go on due diligence trips. We feel that that mitigates any idea of undue influence because the expense was not contingent upon the employee's actions and is actually payment to the agency itself, such as Treasury, with the employee merely acting as an agent of that agency. But nevertheless, the exemption that we propose to this amendment would be tightened even further by getting to the real meat and potatoes of our reasoning, which is that we don't want the SEI form to become a backdoor around disclosure rules. We allow ethics investigations, we allow SEIs especially to be made public, and any item of information that's ordinarily protected from disclosure for any other reason, we wouldn't want getting out through an SEI. In addition, if the there are certain cases in which a third party does not release specific cost information to our employees and is under no legal obligation to do so, in that case, what we would have is a situation in which the employee would be required by statute to put information on the SEI that it was up to a third party whether or not to release to the employee. So having a general partner in a that may serve as a counterparty in negotiations determine whether or not our employees will be up in front of at the Ethics Commission is not the ideal negotiating scenario for us. The second set of amendments, what we've been calling the safe harbor amendments, would, as the dash ones apply to any public employee, not many public employees have the privilege of seeking counsel at every turn when they're making an ethics decision and must rely instead on their agency's rules and procedures. So what we've done, or what we've attempted to do here, is to set up a system in which an employee can act in good faith so long as certain conditions are met. Those conditions require that the employee abide fully by the published policy of their agency, that they believe that it complies with the law, that they act without any attempt to conceal their conduct, and that they cooperate fully with any investigations. In addition, the agency's rules in question must be maintained in writing and publicly available. They must be approved and adopted by the agency's highest policy-making authority after consultation with counsel. They must have been adopted prior to whatever investigation is in question, and they must not, as the committee has noted, be negated by a formal opinion or declaratory ruling by the Ethics Commission. In this situation, it would protect public employees who dutifully abide by their agency's policies. If these policies are later found to conflict with ethics statutes, it would not, the safe harbor would not carry forward. It would be so as to say negated by the Ethics Commission, and it would only be a safe harbor for that first situation. The Treasury does not believe that the amendments as drafted are quite up to snuff, and we would like some time to work with legislative counsel and our counsel in the Department of Justice to make several technical changes to those. But with those two amendments in concept added to the current bill, we would be happy to support that. And I'm going to leave it to myself and Mr. Bond for any questions.
Mr. Bond, did you have testimony, or just are you here to answer questions?
Madam Chair, I am just here to help. But I might.
Why have we heard that before?
I might add that, particularly relative to the SEI discussion, that investment officers, the treasurer, as well as the treasurer, myself, and the chief staff, are already required to fill out a more comprehensive report on our financial activities on a quarterly basis rather than an annual basis. So this would be additive to that that reporting that we already done, that we already do, and doesn't in any way supplant that.
Okay, questions for these witnesses? I actually have a couple of questions for you. So I wonder if you could provide an example or two of what it is you're trying to get at by saying expenses that are incurred pursuant to a contract.
Sure.
I'm not totally clear on what that is.
Madam Chair, for instance, we would send investment officers to, we often, through our private equity and private real estate relationships, we participate on advisory boards. And the treasurer, through our negotiations at the time of entering into the agreement with the partnership, will negotiate a seat on the advisory board. The partnership pays for the expenses of the advisory board for annual meetings, et cetera. And the treasurer then determines who will be sent to participate on his behalf at the advisory board meetings. And in that instance, the expenses associated with the advisory board meeting are expenses that are of the partnership, a private entity, and are maintained by the partnership, and we don't have access, nor does the public employee that we send have access to all of those expenses. If we did have, then of course they're already a public record. Furthermore, I would point out that there is no economic interest on behalf of the employee. The actual economic interest is to the state and usually to OPERF, in that it's important from an information perspective, it's important from a fiduciary perspective that we participate whenever we can at the advisory board level. And so should we be in a position, which in some instances we are, where the advisory board or where the partnership doesn't pay all the expenses, then Treasury and through us, OPERF, would be paying those expenses. So ultimately, the economic interest lies with OPERF as opposed to with the employee directly, because we're going to be either the partnership's going to pay for them to go or we're going to pay for them to go. That's what we're talking about, that kind of activity.
And my other question, and I know you've said you're still working on this language, but there's another provision that exempts expenses from being reported that are otherwise exempt under a statute that I'm not familiar with, 192.410 to 192.505.
Those are related to the public records disclosure laws, and so we just want to make clear that exempt material that's not a public record under the public records laws, there isn't, the SEI doesn't become a back doorway of that information becoming public.
Such as what would that be?
Could be investment related agreements. There's a variety of specific exemptions in the public records laws related to investment related activity and documentation of those activities.
And if I may, Madam Chair, just to clarify that, the regarding expenses that are exempt from disclosure under a contract that is all or partially exempt from disclosure, the subsection B applies only to specific provisions of that contract. So, for instance, if there is a part of the contract that is exempt from disclosure, but a particular expense for whatever reason is not, then that would still be public information. The employee would know it, and it would be found on the statement of economic interest. So it would be possible to have a portion of a contract be exempt from disclosure and a particular amount not be.
Okay. Thank you. So other questions for these witnesses? I don't see any. Oh, yes.
You did say something about doing quarterly reports in addition to what would be required in this bill. Who do you report to quarterly?
The statute requires that a set of people who I described earlier report to the Secretary of State's Audit Division and the Department of Justice, and of course to Treasury. And then actually on top of that, through policy, the Treasury has a more comprehensive list. There are more employees subject to reporting at Treasury. That reporting is just internal. We just manage that internally. And another layer that we have is anytime we hire an employee into one of these sensitive positions or we promote into one of these sensitive positions, we require a full financial disclosure on the part of the employee that's actually much more comprehensive than either of the other two we've discussed. So.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 269 or on Senate Bill 510? Okay, seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 269 and Senate Bill 510. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 273. Erin, could you please tell us about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 273 reduces maximum penalty from $5,000 to $1,000 for failure to file ethics statements in timely manner. There is no revenue impact. There may have a fiscal impact. No statement has been issued yet.
Okay, and I don't see anyone signed up to testify, but Mr. Burson, I do see you here, so I would assume you might have some comments on this bill. Welcome back.
Thank you again for having me again. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And the Ethics Commission has found one of the challenges with the changes to the laws that were made over the last couple of biennium was that the late penalties for filing reports late, whether that be a lobbyist report, entity report, or a statement of economic interest, it's a math equation. And so it's $10 a day for the first 14 days and $50 a day after that until you file up to a maximum of $5,000. And I'd submitted some information to the committee administrator about just basically showing our last four agendas. And we spend an awful lot of time because lobbyists, entities, and SEI filers get letters that say they owe the commission $5,000. And if they're lobbyists and they've missed a couple of quarters, they owe $10,000. And so it's very difficult for the commission. The penalties seem to be pretty extreme to folks. At least that's the feedback we're getting from people. And so we had hope that the Rules Committee could look at this and keep the schedule the same, but top out at a more reasonable level of $1,000. What you'll find is the commission has been using its discretion of authority that was given to them to give people that were first-time offenders a letter of education. So we have been spending a lot of time waiving a lot of penalty, but that first phone call that the commission gets when that person opens up that letter and they owe thousands of dollars to us is tough on us. So that's really what the purpose of the bill was.
And so it's what you're telling us is basically that you don't have discretion right now to suggest a lower fine amount initially, that you're bound by that amount, but obviously from the disposition of these, you've managed to not impose that $5,000 fine in a lot of these cases.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I mean, the statute actually just tells us what the fine will be, and so that, as staff, we don't have the authority to change that fine. That's actually the authority of the seven-member commission. And so we bring those issues to the commission, and then the commission makes a decision on them. But we spend an exorbitant amount of time with each one of those individuals hearing why they filed late and making decisions on them. In fact, like I said, I submitted some agendas that we've had over the last few months, and you'll see that it dominates the commission's agenda. So But you're right. The commission does have the discretion, and they've been using that discretion to lower those fines. And even we actually adopted in rule a matrix that tries to give us some kind of guidance on how we're going to assess the civil penalties.
Okay, and we do have some information that we can make available to other committee members that Mr. Burson was just referring to, showing the number of cases and agendas and how much time it takes up to take these up individually. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the language is not to exceed amount, and the commission has discretion to decide what it's going to charge?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, yes. The statute just gives, like I say, kind of this math equation for how much the penalty is going to be, but it maxes out currently at $5,000. And so once it hits $5,000, it just stays there. When the person files, they'll get a letter from us saying that they owe $5,000 in penalty and asked if they would like to basically approach the commission and ask for consideration. And usually we don't have to ask that question. They usually do want to approach the commission and ask for consideration. And they come before the commission, say why that report was late. A lot of times what we found is it's just changing of jobs. A lot of these lobbyists work for entities that are out of state, and with the transferring of paperwork or different people going to jobs, they miss their deadlines. And so the commission takes into consideration what was given to them as far as the excuse, and then they go ahead and assess a penalty. And actually that assessment can be anywhere from a letter of education up to the $5,000, but we have not found that the commission has done that full amount of the penalty.
Where do the fines go?
To the general fund, sir.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I don't have these other ORSs in front of me, but you've got other fines for $5,000, $25,000. Have you looked at those to see if those are also appropriate?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, we didn't talk about those other fines because those are actually ethics violations, and it's not just the fine that I'm talking about is a fine for late filing. It's not a fine for non-filing. I mean, if you don't file, then that becomes an ethics violation, and so that jumps over into these other categories for not filing. But this is simply once you file, you simply filed. If you filed, you know, I think it ends up being, I forget the number, it's like 48 days late or something like that, that you all of a sudden have a $5,000 penalty. And so we didn't talk about the other ones because that can be anywhere from people not declaring conflicts of interest to people actually taking public resources for their personal benefit, actually stealing from their public body. And so the reason it actually moved up from $1,000 to $5,000 in 2007, and the purpose was to discourage those types of bad behaviors out there.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. I don't see any other questions. So thank you, Mr. Burson, for your testimony. Members, we don't have this bill listed for work session today, so we will have further discussion on it at a future date. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 273, and that completes our work for today. We are going to be meeting next week on March 3rd, and we do actually not on that date, but coming in the month of March, we do have executive appointments coming toward us, so we are working on lining those up for your enjoyment. Thank you very much, and we're adjourned.